Welcome back to Public Address Radio on Radio Live. We've all heard the story, how a group of scientists and spin doctors deliberately clouded the science on smoking in the 1950s and 60s. Well, it turns out the same group of scientists then moved on to obfuscating science around CFCs in the ozone hole, acid rain, and now global warming. All this is detailed in a fascinating and well-researched book entitled Merchants of Doubt by my next guest, Naomi Oreskes. Welcome.
Thank you.
I've got to say, for someone who doesn't read a lot of nonfiction, Merchants of Doubt is a thrilling book. It's like reading something by John Grisham.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you. That's an amazing compliment.
No, but it is very well written. And the story that you construct of effectively a sinister cabal of scientists who from, I mean, we're talking about someone here who was involved in creating the atomic bomb, who then seems to have worked from then on to undermine what we know about science, from tobacco through secondhand smoke, through the ozone, through acid rain, and then most recently, global warming.
Exactly. And that was the story we discovered that we found shocking as well. We were curious about the question of why would scientists challenge scientific evidence? Why would scientists disbelieve the work of their own colleagues? And so we started looking into who these people were, what was driving them. And then when we discovered this pattern that the same people had been involved over and over again, we call them serial contrarians, you know. It's like they just can't stop themselves. And we traced it all the way to the back to the tobacco industry. And as you said, we're able to show that a lot of the motivation for this comes out of their own personal experiences in the Cold War and a set of ideological beliefs that convinced them that they were doing the right thing, that what they were doing, they believed what they were doing wasn't sinister at all. They believed it was for a greater good.
That greater good being?
The defense of the free market, the defense of freedom, and the belief that in order to be free politically and socially, that we had to be committed to a kind of extreme free market system, and that any form of government regulation, even moderate regulation like stopping smoking on airplanes, was a slippery slope to socialism.
It's interesting because I wonder if certain people, you know, now that we know what we know about tobacco smoke and the effects that it has on you, looking at the way that that played out and the way that scientists actively worked to confuse, to obfuscate the truth, that we'll now be able to put that down onto the climate change debate, or in 20 years' time we'll be able to go, that's exactly what happened there. Do you think that that'll be the case?
Well, we certainly hope so, and in a way we hope that people who read the book will say that today, as you just did. I mean, I think once you read the book, you really see that that is exactly the pattern, and that just as we look back now on tobacco and think, well, what were they thinking? Why did we ever believe that? That people will begin to now say that's the same thing about climate change.
What I find very interesting, and we'll explain this for, you know, for the listeners, is that obviously science is all about challenging principles.
Right.
That's not what you're talking about here, is it?
Right, and that's part of the paradox of the whole story, and that's the part that's a little subtle and is not always easy to explain in a soundbite, and it's why scientists have been a bit flummoxed in trying to counter this, because you're absolutely right. Science thrives on skepticism. Science thrives on healthy skepticism and healthy curiosity, and it thrives on people who are willing to accept the conventional wisdom, who do demand evidence and don't just believe things because everyone else does. But still, there's a difference between healthy skepticism, honest skepticism, and a kind of ideologically driven rejection of data. And what we show in the book is that we're really talking about the latter, and that if you look closely, you actually can tell the difference. And in the book, we talk about what some of those differences are.
You had a very good example, I thought, with the tobacco aspect, where scientists were putting out a list of questions, i.e. why is, you know, in two cities with similar smoking rates, why is cancer worse in this city? Aha, it can't be smoking. The scientists already knew what the answer to that question was, and it had nothing to do with the fact that smoking was, you know, wasn't bad for you.
Exactly.
But they put the questions out knowing the answers, knowing that journalists won't know the answers.
Exactly. So it's a kind of distracting technique. And we say it's a bit like the magician, you know, who's distracting you with one hand while he does the trick with the other. And so they would pose these rhetorical questions, as you say, well, how come, you know, cancer rates are just as bad in, you know, one city as another. They actually knew the answer. The answer was, well, that was a terribly polluted city or something like that. But by posing the question, it made it seem as if we didn't know the answers to these questions, even though, in fact, we really did. And as you say, journalists who are not experts in these subjects wouldn't know that. And so they would say, oh, yeah, good question. Why is that? And so the impression would be left with the listener that there was still a lot of doubt about these matters.
What role is there, though, you know, for actual well-regarded peer-reviewed research that shows alternative results?
Well, there's always a place for that. And if you look at peer-reviewed literature, you often find that if people who have alternative views have evidence, then they don't have any trouble at all getting those papers published. And in the literature now, I mean, my earlier work was exactly on this question. If you read the scientific literature on climate change, you find there are very active and robust debates about all kinds of questions about what's going to happen in the future, about how quickly the West Antarctic ice sheet might break up, about certain kinds of biological impacts, about ocean acidification. These are all areas of live debate, and you can find many questions, many papers about them. But the basic question, is there climate change? Is it underway? Is it caused by human activities? No, there's no debate about that because that is settled, and it has been settled for nearly 20 years.
Well, you say it's settled, but obviously it's not. I mean, obviously there are people, and there are scientists out there. I mean, a survey, recent survey in the US, I believe, said that I think it was 80% of scientists.
Yeah, and this is one of the obfuscatory or confusing techniques that are used.
Right.
Well, so these people are not really scientists. A lot of these claims are frankly just false. They're untrue. And it was one of the shocking things for us writing this book to be able to confront the fact that there are people in the world who can look you in the eye and lie. And if you're raised as a scientist, as I was, and trained to believe in the truth and believe in evidence, it's actually rather shocking to discover that. You know, you feel sort of like you've lost your innocence. So it's simply not true. If you do... Well, first of all, a survey is not how you find out about science. Science is not about opinion. It's not about belief. It's about data and evidence. And the place you find that data is in the peer-reviewed literature. So the only relevant question is, what is being demonstrated in the peer-reviewed scientific literature? And I myself did that study in 2004. I published in a peer-reviewed journal, and I was able to show that there was no debate in the scientific literature. There was a famous person, or not famous at the time, he's famous now, who in Liverpool who tried to challenge it. He has since retracted his challenge and admitted that actually I was correct all along. So no one has shown otherwise in the peer-reviewed literature with any claim based on data.
So you say, I mean, you say science, it's not based on opinion, but people do, the great unwashed, that you know, your layperson, we have to take our, we have to almost believe science on faith, don't we? Because we can't go and become PhD qualified in, you know, in meteorology and, you know, all these other things that we need to even be able to get to grips with it. We do need to take science on faith. Is that where the problem starts?
Well, exactly. And we discuss this at the end of the book. So it's part of the dilemma that we all face, that science is based on evidence. Science is not based on taking things on faith. And yet, as citizens, as lay people, we are in a little bit of a bind, but we can still ask questions about the evidence. We can still ask legitimate questions about what the evidence is. And that's where people like me and my author, co-author Eric Conway, come in, that we are trained as scientists, but we became historians of science and we read the scientific literature. And part of what we're trying to do in the book is explain what the science is, where it comes from, what the evidence is, but why so many of us have not understood it, because we have been subject to this large campaign, large and consistent campaign of misinformation.
You say as a scientist that you're surprised or you know, maybe perhaps naive in some ways when someone looks you in the face and lies to you. Does it surprise you that journalists face the same dilemma?
No, not at all. I mean, I think the thing is, you know, we expect politicians to lie, but we don't expect scientists to lie. And so I think that's what's made it hard for all of us. And of course, the other part of the story that we tell in the book is that we have to be more discriminating about who is really a scientist. It's not enough just to say, oh, I'm a scientist. It's like that great scene in the movie Ghostbusters where Bill Murray says, back off, lady, we're scientists. So we're not saying that. What we're saying is that the people we need to trust, the people who've actually done the work. So the people in our story would say, oh, we're scientists. But in reality, they had not actually done any research on climate change. They had not done research on tobacco, acid rain, ozone, or any of these other issues.
They were just rent a quote, basically.
In effect. I mean, they were scientists early in their career, but in a wholly different area. So I think that the public and journalists need to be more discerning and say, well, what kind of a scientist are you? Are you actually a specialist in this area? Have you actually done the research? Have you collected data? Have you published it? And if journalists would ask that question, 99% of the contrarians and skeptics would fall away.
It's very interesting. Do you think that part of the problem, this is a common favorite theme of mine, is the problem is journalists are trying to be fair and balanced, and they think if they haven't got the other side of the story, that every story needs the one person who says, nah, it's rubbish.
Right. And again, we talk about this in the book as well. So it's what we call false balance or false equivalence. I mean, of course, you can always find someone to disagree, but the question is, does that person actually have evidence? Do they have data? Or is it just some random opinion. And so, you know, you wouldn't invite, if you were doing a story about plate tectonics, you wouldn't invite somebody who doesn't believe that continents move. But if there were something at stake economically, I guarantee you we could find people who would be prepared to come on the radio and tell you that continents don't move, even living in New Zealand where you're sitting right on one of the world's major faults.
When it comes to climate change, it does seem, though, that there are plenty of people who have read stuff. They've read scientific reports that they believe that say that it's not happening or that we're not causing it and whatnot. So you're saying, in summary, we should say to someone, have you done any work on this yourself if you're a scientist? Has it been peer-reviewed? Or has your evidence been peer-reviewed? And if not, go away.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And you'll find many of these so-called reports that are on the blogosphere do not meet those criteria.
Fantastic. That's all because of the worldwide conspiracy by people like you to keep it down. Though.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Exactly. As I always say, we should all be so organized.
Look, it is a fantastic book. It's an eye-opener, I imagine, for a lot of people that maybe don't believe in global warming, if they could actually be brave enough to pick it up and read it and have some of their views challenged. And it's a fascinating history, if nothing else. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be here.
That's Naomi Oreskes. And the book, Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming, is out through Allen & Unwin. After the break, new music from Princess Chelsea.